to put that one on for Thursday, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thursday?
Thursday.
Okay. Let's do the public hearing on 2494 and 24. We've got Max Williams here from the House Judiciary Committee. So, Max, you want to come forward and tell us why you sent these to us?
Some form of torture was.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate you taking me. First this morning, I'm going to make my remarks. I won't try to advertise my sale and parking ticket that somehow got confused in my file here, which I need to remember to pay or it'll become more expensive. Yeah, it very well may be. House Bill 2494 and House Bill 2498 were bills that were moved on by the House Judiciary Committee and passed across the floor. Both bills were part of a larger package that the committee examined for a considerable period of time in an effort to discuss the broad subject matter where we started of medical malpractice liability reform. I want to start out by attempting not to oversell 2494-2498 to you as a committee. I think both bills on their individual merits have value, but I would be the first one to tell you that I don't, you know, sincerely believe that these bills are going to substantially change medical malpractice liability insurance coverage or expense. I am pleased to tell you that later this week we'll have a bill on the floor of the House that I think at least makes some important steps temporarily on that issue, and it will be, I hope, this committee's pleasure to entertain that bill when it comes over. But these bills individually on their merits, I think, bear this committee's consideration. 2494 is essentially a bill that would require the disclosure of expert witnesses in a litigation matter. And I think you'll hear some testimony from some people who just flat out hate the idea. I think you'll hear some others who may offer you some suggestions, which I would commend to your consideration about how to make the bill better. But fundamentally, what the bill would do is it would require that a party disclose who their expert witness would be in a litigation matter. And this would make us consistent with virtually 48 other states in the union that require expert witness disclosure. It's my firm belief that this bill offers sufficient protections to deal with the issues that some of the opponents of the bill raise, one concern being that it would increase costs. I actually believe that requiring the disclosure of expert in a case will actually move the case along in a more effective manner, requiring the parties to decide whether they really want to take the case forward when it comes time to having to decide to hire their expert or perhaps settle the case in advance of that. But under any set of circumstances, I think it would expedite and move the process forward in my own opinion. I also think that the Senator, you dropped some of your papers.
Yeah, I didn't notice that.
I also think, Mr. Chairman, that the bill has sufficient provisions in it in subsection B that with respect to modifications by the court, where the court can modify the nature of the disclosure if there is good cause shown, and actually enter protective orders if there is a reason why disclosure of the witness would be disadvantageous to one party in a manner that would sufficiently convince the judge that disclosure would not be required. As I point out, this is similar to what 48 other states and the federal civil procedure system requires, except that in our case, we are really limiting what the disclosure is and the nature of the disclosure. It requires the name and the address, the qualifications of the expert, including a list of their publications, the compensation paid or to be paid to the expert witness for the preparation of the trial, and then a listing of any other cases in which the witness has testified. So that's the information that would be disclosed. It would not be comprehensive expert reports detailing what the expert might testify to, as is done, for example, in federal court, but it would be this limited information that would be required for disclosure, and obviously both sides in a litigation would be required to make that disclosure. So fundamentally, I think that that's a good thing. In Oregon, for those of you who have had some experience, we often have what's called trial by ambush. You show up at the courthouse in a civil case at a state level, and you oftentimes don't know the expert that's going to be walking in the back of the courtroom. In my view, that leads to a lot of additional efforts in a litigation as the parties try to discern from what's being said who the expert might be, and preparing a whole bunch of stuff that may or may not be useful in anticipation of who they might have had or might have as an expert. I think this disclosure gets both sides on the same page. They understand who the witnesses are going to be. They have an opportunity to investigate a little bit about the witness, and that's one of the purposes here, is to allow both sides the opportunity to figure out who that expert's going to be, what their testimony in other cases, similar kinds of cases, might have been. And ultimately, I think that proves helpful to the fact finder in deciding and determining the case. So that's House Bill 2494. I commend it to you as I think a worthy piece of legislation standing on its own. If you want, Mr. Chair, I'd be pleased to talk about 2498
along
here.
Yes, please.
House Bill 2498 also was in the package of bills that were reviewed by the House Judiciary Committee. There were a number of bills. These are the only two that the committee found sufficiently worthy to forward on to you. This bill essentially adjusts the statutory rate of interest. Currently, interest is at 9% per annum in a civil matter. If you get a judgment, the interest on that judgment is at 9%. As you well know, most things these days aren't paying 9% interest. And what this bill essentially does is it changes the interest rate and ties the interest rate to, and you'll see in subsection 3, the rate for judgments for the payment of money described in subsection 2 of this section is a rate equal to the weekly average one-year constant maturity treasury yield as published by the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System for the calendar week. It's essentially the same mechanism that the federal court uses to calculate interest on federal court judgments. It would be a sliding interest scale. There's no question about that, but again, as I point out, it's the way the federal system currently works, and it's a more fair methodology of calculating the interest. The House amended the bill to essentially take out, and Mr. Joseph can help me on the details, but my recollection is we removed the small claims judgments off of this and allowed them to stay in place at the 9% rate of interest. But on large judgments, it would be this federal interest mechanism that would determine the interest rate on judgments. That bill, as I recall, came out of committee with very little opposition and I think passed the House floor without any opposition. The expert witness bill that I previously discussed was a bit more controversial both in committee and on the floor, and I think you'll find that to be the case here in the hearing in front of you. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's a brief introduction to why we sent these bills over to you. I commend them to the committee, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions that you wish to ask.
All right. Thank you very much for the overview. Any questions by the committee for Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I do have a question about the disclosure of the fees paid to the expert witnesses. I wonder if that is a potentially prejudicial issue, or whether or not there's a judgment attached to the price tag on an expert. I mean, what's the point of disclosing the fee paid to the expert witness, since some of the expert witnesses serve without fee, others are fabulously expensive? And I think that's got to create some apprehension in the opposing camp about the quality of the testimony, or, you know, how is that information germane?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, it's pretty common practice, even in the trial by ambush, to start quizzing the expert about how much he was paid for his testimony. And typically they'll say, I'm not paid anything for my testimony, but the services for evaluating the case were as follows. So it's a pretty common practice for that information to come in front of the jury. You know, to the extent that the expert is a professional, whether it's, you know, an engineer or an architect or a doctor or somebody else, I think people, you know, are going to anticipate that individual is going to be paid. I don't think disclosure of that in advance is any more prejudicial than sort of, you know, requiring that disclosure at the time of trial and trying to make it look like the guy was, you know, proffering himself only for money and that his opinion was subject to that charge. But it is information that typically comes in trials, in my experience anyway, so I'm not sure that it's any more prejudicial by requiring a disclosure of it in this disclosure document than it would be just asking the questions in front of the jury at trial.
All right, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rubio.
Thank you. On 2498, where does one find the average one-year constant maturity treasury yield? Is that published in the Oregonian, Wall Street Journal? Where do you go?
I'm trying to recall, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, the testimony in the hearing. My understanding is that it's available on a website that's fairly accessible, that's put out by the Federal Treasury Department. I certainly know that from my experience, the federal court has never had problems telling
right.
me what the current rate of interest was when I needed to figure that out in preparing a federal judgment. And I would assume that the same kinds of opportunities for getting that information would exist if this were adopted.
Sure, that's true. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? There are none. Thank you, Representative. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
All right. We'll start with 2494, and we have a Russ. I'm going to butcher the name. I know it. Lipetsky, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Russ Lipetsky. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I do family law cases. And I'm here offering amendments, which I should give.
I think what we're going to do is we're going to do public testimony on both of these, since you've signed up for both and just redeem the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2494 and 2498, I think were drafted and have been discussed without really envisioning how it might impact domestic relations cases and divorce cases. And us family law attorneys don't want to really be caught in the crossfire and be subject to some unintended results of these bills. The disclosure bill, 2494, which requires disclosure of experts, would really have a significant impact in domestic relations cases in which the experts are not typically appearing on behalf of one party or another, but are appearing on behalf of the family and the children to make recommendations to the court. And to put these procedural requirements and disclosure requirements and all the other things of the bill, to have those applied to an expert in a family law case doesn't make any sense. It is going to create a whole bunch of work. It's going to create a whole bunch of problems, especially for pro se individuals who make up a good portion of domestic relations practice in the courts. And so we're asking that it be excluded, that family law cases be excluded if this bill is going to go through. It just doesn't really make any sense to have it apply to family law cases. And we're happy to answer questions about that issue.
All right. I don't sense any questions.
All right.
I'm sorry, Senator Ringo.
Were these concerns raised at all on the House side?
Not that I know of. I wasn't involved. I think this bill kind of went below the radar of the family law practitioners. I have been in touch with the executive committee of the family law section. I'm not appearing on behalf of the family law section of the state bar, but I know that from my discussions with the section that the members concur with the concerns that I've raised.
Thank you.
All right.
2498, my big concern about this one in terms of family law cases is how it's going to impact child support judgments, which under current law become a new judgment every month as they accrue. And I think the effect, as I'm interpreting this bill, would be that each and every month, every child support obligation would have a different interest rate. And when you're going back, sometimes years later, and going back to try to calculate child support arrearages, you would, in effect, be having a different interest rate each and every month, and it would just be an incredibly burdensome and unwieldy process to go through and try to calculate a variable interest rate on child support arrearages. And again, I think I understand the drafters of the bill, what they were getting at, but us divorce lawyers don't really care about med malpractice, but we're very concerned about domestic relations cases. And again, all the pro se parties in these cases who aren't going to have a clue how to deal with this, especially when they're going back to try to calculate child support arrearages. So I have not drafted amendments to that particular bill, but I simply raised the concern about how it would impact a divorce case and judgments in a divorce case.
Hello, Mr. Lipetsky, based on previous testimony regarding the interest rates for arrearages, the Department of Justice will simply accept whatever you give them, from what I understand.
No, actually, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Justice will require the citizen to do the calculation.
But then they accept it.
Well, they may or may not. I mean, the point is it creates a rebuttable presumption, and then people argue about the arrearage interest rates or the calculations.
That's right, Mr. The Department of Justice, they do not calculate interest rates. It's left to the individual. And again, when you're having a variable rate like this, to expect, again, the large percentage of people that don't even have attorneys to go out and hire accountants to calculate those kinds of arrearage figures, you're really putting quite a burden on those folks.
Right. Mr.
Chairman, so do you have a suggestion?
Exclude domestic relations cases. I don't have drafted amendments, but I think you need to exclude child support orders from this bill if you're going to move it forward, or you're going to really create problems.
Mr. Chair,
sure.
But I think the point of the bill is that 9% is
high.
Too high. It's too high. So how do you address that?
If you wanted to lower it to some arbitrary, right, or less steep but still arbitrary figure, I mean, mm-hmm, that becomes much less unwieldy. As long as it's a constant rate, it's just easy to calculate 5% as it is 9%, or as difficult. It's the variable nature of it that I think is going to create a problem.
Just out of curiosity, why wouldn't you let the court set the interest rate for the child support and then allow that interest rate to continue as part of the judgment?
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I don't think you'd have any consistency from judge to judge or court to court. I think you would really...
You mean justice is uneven?
Yes. Justice is inconsistent.
Yes. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well,
Senator Walker, question?
Well, the alternative, when Senator Ringo asked him how we could fix this, he said exclude Don Rell cases, but there's another alternative, Mr. Chair, and it's not passing the bill.
I think that rests in your hands. All right, next up on this fine topic, I got John Phillips on 2498, mm-hmm, but you're not signed up on now. Okay. Well, you're from the Department of Revenue, so must be a reason tied to this interest rate bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. If Diane Belt might join me, we're
sure
here on the same brief issue.
Yeah.
I'm with the Department of Revenue. My name is John Phillips. On 2498, reading the bill recently, we noticed that this bill casts a wider net possibly than what the intention was. And for property tax purposes, property taxes become judgments, and the interest rate has been 9%. It's tied to the same statute that's being amended, and if the net is being cast further than what you intend, then we're suggesting an amendment, and it's listed on my testimony there. Just briefly, in Section 1, to add a subsection D to exclude properties that are in foreclosure for which a judgment and decree has been issued. It's just a simple amendment. We have to answer any questions on that.
Did you testify in the House?
Actually, this was also under our radar screen, and we missed it until just this week, so I apologize for that. No, we didn't.
All right.
I've spoken with Scott Gallant and one of the other lobbyists that did testify on the House side, and they said that this was not where they were headed.
All right. Great. Ms. Belt?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Diane Belt, and I'm with the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also employed by Washington County. As John said, this is something that at first when we looked at the bill, it really wasn't of interest to us, and then when the Angross bill came out, we had our legal counsel look through it to see if it did affect our judgment interest on delinquent property taxes. And he felt the bill was a little ambiguous and was concerned that it could be taken either way, and suggested that we ask for an amendment to define that it does not include our foreclosure judgment. The way it's written, it would kind of take away our consistency in that, because it's a fluctuating rate and counties take their judgment at different times during the month of September. You could have a property owner that owned property in two different counties and have two different rates of interest. And we would just as soon keep our statutes intact.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? There are none. Thank you for your testimony. Mark Comstock. Oregon State Farm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Comstock. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem. I represent the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor section in opposition to 2498A as it is proposed to you here. what the basis of the opposition is that this is really settled law right now. It is a uniform 9% interest rate. The bill, as it's proposed to you, raises some public policy issues. It creates a disincentive to pay off a judgment. Currently, the rate is 1.13%, and that is as of the Federal Reserve determination of May 29. And that was the most recent publication of the rate. So if we really look at this bill, and if I was presenting a judgment today to the court, the court would not know what the judgment rate would be to put in the judgment.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
But you say the court wouldn't know it. The attorneys just informed the court that the weekly average one-year constant maturity treasury yield would be X percent, and wouldn't the court just accept that under judicial notice and plug in that number?
Well, I'd appreciate it. Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I believe the court certainly could accept that. But the difficulty with that is litigants don't know when a court is going to sign a judgment and when a court clerk would enter the judgment in the register. It may be 1, 2, or 3 weeks or more. So the interest rate may well change. And I did print out from the Federal Reserve website, and it's 6 pages of various rates for various judgments, various rates for various money instruments. And that would cause a clerk to have to decide which judgment applied. And I believe that creates a potential liability for the judicial department. I don't know if that is a ministerial act or a discretionary act. Mm-hmm. And that causes concern to me.
Mr. Comstock, do you practice in federal court?
I do,
so
Mr.
Do you deal with judgments in federal court?
I do.
Because if this is a standard in federal cases, how do they do it?
How, Mr. Chair, how they do it is the federal judicial office back in Washington, D.C., sends out an email each week to the various clerks to identify what the interest rate is for that particular week. And
would it be impractical that our judicial department couldn't do the same?
Well, Senator Miss, certainly the judicial department could do that.
Maybe we'd get the feds to email it to us, too.
Well, I don't know. It certainly could be done, but that is certainly a burden on the judicial department to do so and make sure that it gets distributed to whichever deputy clerk is doing the entry on the computer on any particular time. This bill also has some unintended consequences. From the original bill, it was limited to judgments arising on medical malpractice cases. Well, as I read the bill right now, contract actions and account actions bear interest at 9%, but all other judgments would bear interest at the variable rate. Well, Mr. Lepetsky identified that includes statutory actions such as child support. It would include statutory actions such as unlawful trade practices and other statutory damage claims. So those are all within this variable rate, where that does have an impact on state judgments, certainly, because the committee can recall it is the Attorney General's office that goes after unlawful trade practice claims quite often. The bill, I think, also creates a disincentive to not appeal the case. That's a poorly worded sentence, but
if the interest rate is 1.13, I may well be able to go invest money during the appeal instead of paying the judgment, and make money instead of paying the judgment. When there is an appeal at 9%, it's more difficult to borrow money at 9%. Finally, the bill in Section 3 creates an ambiguity, and I identify this in my written testimony, but Section 3 amends ORS 90.260 to provide that the unpaid late charge rate is the rate identified in ORS 82.010. Well, 82.010 has 9% in one section and has the variable rate in the other. And if you are a landlord trying to decide what rate you're going to have on a late charge, you're going to have to figure out what the interest rate is. And if you have multiple late charges, again, it varies. The debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar urges that this bill not be passed out of committee and be rethought. And I'd be pleased to answer any other questions.
I have one question. Did you testify on the House side?
Mr. Chair, I found out about this bill the day of the work session where the amendments came out, and I was prepared to testify, but there wasn't sufficient time for me to testify.
So you found out about it at the time of the work session?
At the time of when it came out.
Did they hold public hearings over there?
I believe they did hold public hearings.
We did, Mr. Chair, for 2 days.
For 2 days?
I understand that the Practice and Procedure Committee conveyed some concerns to the committee.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Unless there are some other questions, Senator Ringo.
I just want to step through one more time. Your reading of the bill is that for a contract action, it would remain 9%?
Yes.
Even though the contract may not specify the interest rate, if there's a judgment on an action arising from that contract, the rate's 9%.
Senator Minnis, Senator Ringo, as I read 82.010 sub 1.
I'm sorry, exactly where is that?
That is on the first page of the A engrossed version of the bill, mm-hmm. starting at line 6.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets the rate of interest for identified transactions at 9%. All monies when they become due or on open accounts, those are essentially contract actions. Money received for the use of another beyond the reasonable time is a quasi contract action.
I see, right.
And then money due or to become due where there's a contract to pay interest and no rate is specified. So that would be a contract. Now, Senator Ringo is correct that if the contract provides an interest rate, such as a credit card contract, it would bear interest at the credit card rate, which may be 18, 25, whatever it might be. So there are varying interest rates.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How long has the interest rate been 9%?
Senator Ringo, I started practicing in 1981, and I believe for the first couple of years of my practice, the interest rate was at 6%. At my memory, at some point during that time frame, it went to 9%, and it's been that rate since that time.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Appreciate your testimony. Let's see where we go from here. I think we'll bring up Mike Crew and Scott Gallant, Oregon Medical Association.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. With me is Mike Crew with Cooney & Crew, our outside counsel. I appreciate the opportunity to make some brief comments. Mr. Crew will probably carry the weight of the testimony today on the comments that have been made previously, but I'd like to make a couple quick and brief comments. First of all, we did hold at the request of the chairman and under the supervision of your staff a work group with representatives of the Medical Association, Hospital Association, State Bar, trial attorneys, and others on three bills. Two of the bills are before the committee today. And I'm sure that in working through the various issues that are coming up today, that it was just not possible to concentrate on the potential impact that apparently these bills might have in the practice of law in some areas. So my point is, I'm a little surprised that these issues are coming up today. It does happen in the legislative process, but I think the chairman on the House side most certainly tried to provide everyone with an interest, no pun intended, on these bills to have an opportunity to provide input to try to address the issues that have been raised. I mean, fundamentally, though, we believe that these bills have merit, that it does not make sense for civil litigation to be done by ambush, as the chairman of the House committee indicated. And we try to avoid causing major costs through the disclosure of expert witnesses to make it a reasonable bill with a reasonable period of time. And we think we accomplished that. So we would hope that you would work with us on this legislation to actually move them out of committee. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Gallant.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Cooney and Crew. We are outside counsel in the OMA, and we also have a general trial practice. With regard to 2494, that was the product, by and large, of a work session of interested parties, and the basic consensus was, at least, that the parties that were in favor of the bill would only support limited disclosure, which the bill reflects, and also that the bill cuts, if you will, in both directions, namely, it's a disclosure by both parties, plaintiff and defense, and therefore it really does stop this concept of trial by ambush. The vast majority of states do have a disclosure bill, as does the federal bar. And we believe it's time that Oregon provide for disclosure of experts. And it's our firm belief that it, in fact, will aid in the settlement of cases, particularly in medical malpractice cases, where you know what the plaintiff side of the case is and the plaintiff knows what the defense side of the case is, at least as to experts. So in that regard, we do believe it would be of help in the medical malpractice arena. With regard to House Bill 2498, the interest bill, that was the product, again, of a work group. There was discussion about lowering the amount of interest from 9% down to a lesser number. We couldn't seem to find a consensus on what that lesser number was. We talked about the federal rate and the fact that it indeed was, at that time, 1.25%, I believe. And there was concern that it was too low, and we talked about capping it or putting in a bump, say the federal rate plus 3%, which is in fact done in several states. But the consensus of the committee is that if the objective was to find an interest bill that reflected the economy, then the fair thing to do is to let it float with the economy. And that's the result that came out and is reflected in 2498. With regard to figuring out what the interest rate is, all you have to do is turn on your computer and go to the website for the Federal Reserve System. I agree that there are a list of interest rates there, but all you have to do is look for the constant, the 1 week constant maturity rate, and it will take you to the website or the table for that on a daily basis. And if you go to that website, you will find the interest rate for the that's set forth in the bill for the last 40 years. So one can readily see what's going on. But more importantly, if you are looking at a judgment where you're going to have to make various calculations, it's quite simply done because it gives you a 40-year history and goes back on a weekly basis, and you can get that daily. So I don't think it's much of a challenge to find it. With regard to the issue on contracts, that was brought up on the House side, and I would say that the way the bill is now written, if a contract doesn't specify an interest rate, it's 9%. That's subsection 1 of 82010, and what the bill says. But if there is a different contract amount agreed to, that's the interest rate that will be applied. So if the contract specifies 12% or 18%, that indeed is what the judgment will be for. It allows the parties to strike a bargain in the contract, and if they don't, then the statute applies 9%. So I don't think that really is an impact upon the rate of interest that is available to litigants at this point in time. It would still be 9% if they hadn't agreed otherwise. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions?
Yes.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krug, how would you respond to some of the concerns that have been raised this morning about House Bill 2498? I don't want to talk about 2494 right now, just 2498.
2498?
Mm-hmm.
Well, admittedly, it started out as a bill that there was an attempt to limit it to only, a proposal to limit it to only medical malpractice actions. It got broadened, if you will, because other interested parties felt that the interest rate was generally unfair at 9% given the current return on investments, and that it should affect all parties equally. There was no consideration given to special interests such as the domestic relations side, tax issues, etc. It's unfortunate those weren't raised on that side because presumably they would have been accommodated.
Well, do you have an objection now to trying to accommodate those interests?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I'm assuming that if accommodation can be reached, that certainly they should be accommodated. Ideally, you have one interest rate that all parties are bound by. It's a much clearer rule, but if there needs to be exceptions, then so be it.
Just as a comment, Mr. Chair, I find it interesting that everyone says the 9% rate is too high when we currently pay 12% on property tax appeals in this state. And when I tried to get that changed this session, I couldn't do it. And I just think that's patently unfair because you can do just not pay your property taxes and then you can appeal your property taxes and get 12% interest on that. But that's an aside. Just a commentary, another committee, directed at a committee member sitting next to me.
To your right or left?
To my right.
Because I'm not getting anything. Okay, great. Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Ringo?
How do you evaluate the argument that people won't have incentive to pay judgments because the interest rate is so low?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I hadn't really thought about that. I suppose theoretically that it could be argued that there would be no incentive to pay off a judgment except for reality. And the reality is if you have a judgment against you and you attempt to borrow money, you attempt to obtain financing or any other financial transaction, you won't get it. Therefore, I think there is more than adequate incentive to pay off judgments, unless, of course, you're going to appeal it, in which case you'll post a bond. So I don't think that the disincentive is necessarily a very large problem.
Mr. Chair, it's a follow-up. Yes. I mean, but don't you think that by lowering the interest rate, you are going to give incentive for filing appeals where the merits may be somewhat marginal? But at least you can drag it out for a few years before you actually have to pay the judgment. And during that period of time, you're only paying 1% on that money, whereas otherwise you'd be having to pay 3%.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I suppose that's a possibility. However, there is a cost of money, and to file a frivolous appeal, you'll have to pay that. You'll have to post a bond. Bonds are expensive. And I suspect that the propensity to file a frivolous appeal would be no greater. In this instance, than currently. And I might point out that as a general proposition that the Oregon State Bar has rules of ethics and procedural rules against filing frivolous appeals.
Mr. Chair, I did not say frivolous. I mean, there's lots of judgment calls as to what the Court of Appeals is going to do. I mean, nobody knows for sure on any given case. And I said of a marginal merit. But there's lots of judgment calls, and oftentimes appeals can be filed even though the parties know it's a long shot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, possibly there may be more appeals filed that may have marginal merits, but one could argue the reverse of that, in that under current rates, where possibly cases would be appealed, they won't be appealed, where there are good questions of law, simply because 9%, frankly, is a barrier to the appeal. I can think of several cases in that regard that involved professional negligence where you simply couldn't afford to appeal it. You couldn't even buy the bond. You had to go ahead and pay the judgment. So I think that argument cuts both ways.
Well, just to follow, Mr. Chair, it sounds like then you at least are agreeing that by lowering the interest rate, we're going to see more appeals. Agreed to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I do not agree with that. I can't forecast how many appeals are going to be filed. I'm assuming that
Mr. Chair, you just said that the 9% was a barrier to appeal.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, it has acted as a barrier to appeal in at least two cases I'm aware of.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? There are none. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate being here. Jim Dorrigan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having me here to testify today. I'm testifying in support of 2494 and 2498. First of all, to go back a little bit of a history of these two bills, they came out as two of the...
Just give us your name for the record, if you would. I'm sorry.
My name is Jim Dorrigan. I'm CEO of Northwest Physicians Mutual Medical Malpractice. Insuring approximately 40% of Oregon physicians. These two bills were two of the proposed solutions coming out of the governor's task force of 2002, of which I was a member. They were two of the least controversial proposals and the only two solutions currently being actively considered in this legislative session. Let me talk about these two bills. First of all, on the expert witness bill, 2494. It aligns Oregon with 48 other states and the federal courts in terms of disclosure of experts. One of the issues that I was concerned about on this for both sides was the introduction of additional experts late in the course of a trial or in the course of developing the experts for the trial. But it does have a provision to allow experts and the introduction of experts later in the process. What this will do is it will facilitate settlements and help clear civil cases out of a crowded court system. It requires both sides to prepare and line up their experts and disclose them earlier on in the process. Therefore, I believe it will bring both parties to the table earlier in order to discuss settlements and get cases settled that need to be settled that are currently clogging up the system. The costs of disclosing expert witnesses are minimal. I don't think that will add added costs. Also, it's going to balance a little bit the system as it currently exists. Right now in the trial by ambush system, experts are disclosed at time of trial. What it does is it allows the plaintiffs about a week or however long it takes for them to put on their case to research and get information about the defense experts. But the defense is put at an immediate disadvantage in that the experts are lined up in the hall, ready to go, and the defense does not have really time to research who the plaintiff's experts are. So we feel that it's a positive bill, and it will help facilitate dismissal of cases that should be dismissed early on in the process and also facilitate settlements of cases that will eventually be settled or need to be settled. On the interest rate bill, we feel that it aligns the Oregon rules with the federal rules in terms of interest rates. 9% is a very high interest rate right now, and it makes it difficult to proceed into an appeal. And if a case is put on appeal, it provides very little incentive for the plaintiffs to settle a case because 9% is much higher than the interest rates that they would be able to obtain in the marketplace. What we see in terms of appeal of verdicts is we see far more defense verdicts being appealed than plaintiffs' verdicts, and there is absolutely no penalty for appealing defense verdicts in particularly medical malpractice cases. So overall, I would encourage the support and passage of both of these bills. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Mr. Dorgan, you mentioned the governor's task force. Did the governor's task force, how long did it meet? Who was part of it? And did you come out with formal recommendations, or were these just a bunch of things kind of on a list that maybe might work?
Well, it met throughout most of 2002 and into the first part of 2003. I believe the final composition of the task force, there were 12 members. It had a very diverse group of members. Representative Williams was on the committee. We had a member of the Trial Lawyers Association, the Oregon Medical Association, several consumer groups. And really the purpose of the task force was to identify proposed solutions. It did not rank the solutions. It did not eliminate solutions unless there were unanimous opinions toward eliminating the proposed solution. So it really laid out kind of a broad range of solutions.
So, Mr. Chair, could I continue? Would it be fair to say that the solutions that the task force came up with were not unanimous in scope? They were just, some members thought that they were solutions and some members didn't?
There was, with the diverse parties in the task force, there were no universally applauded or approved solutions, and the task force was not asked to put forth a ranking or a vote on the solutions. These were two of the solutions that seemed to have the least amount of opposition because they did not have any constitutional issues. They were viewed more as mechanical issues. I know the trial lawyers were opposed to both of these, as they were to most of the tort reform-related type solutions.
And then did you forward the list of recommendations to the governor, and the governor passed on any of those with his magic wand? Or?
Well, by the time the task force was completed with its work, the governor was out of office, and there was a change of office, so the solutions were and the report were passed on to Governor Kulongoski and also to Governor Kitzhaber as he was going out the door.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
All right. We've got a panel here. Wait a minute, Mark Morrell. Sorry. And Jack Everett. Then we'll get the panel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Mark Morrell, and with me to my right is Everett Jack. I am currently have the honor of serving as chairman of the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. I have appeared before you in the past. Mr. Jack is a member of my committee, a new admittee, so to speak. I will tell you up front that both Mr. Jack and I do both plaintiff's work and defense work as a part of our practice. He works for Davis Wright Germain. I work for myself. We are here to talk about 2494 today. And I have three short points, and I'll make them as quickly as I can. Feel free to interrupt me if I confuse you or if you want to ask questions. The Procedure and Practice Committee is about 14 strong, equally divided between defense and plaintiff's bar. Nothing in my 4 years on that committee has ever left the room without unanimous consensus. So when I talk to you I talk to you not just as the chairman, but as the voice of the entire committee. And we are asking that you take a hard look at this particular piece of legislation and compare it with a more systemic approach to the problem. Civil procedure in the Oregon courts is a balanced system that allows each advocate to protect his position. This changes that. The balance of interests have arisen in this system over about 100 years. Let me give you an example. If I expose my expert to discovery by the other side, there is a chance that the other side will tamper with that witness. This piece of legislation doesn't protect me from the other side tampering.
Let me ask you the question. Tamper with the witness?
Yeah.
Isn't that a criminal offense?
It can be. It can be so subtle as to not constitute a crime, but...
How would they tamper with the witness? Or
Mr. Chairman, we have evidence that in cases the experts from either side are influenced by their peers, and suggestions are made that they should not testify, they should change their testimony. Although this is probably not something that comes up all the time or even occasionally, that it comes up at all is a problem, and we would ask that, you know.
So I guess my next question is, how do the other 48 states get along with the disclosure issue?
Well, the disclosure doesn't change the way you react to an improper contact. It just makes it more likely. The federal courts still strike you with the hammer of God if you tamper with a witness, and
right.
So do other state courts.
I mean, we do in criminal cases, we arrest the people.
And if it rises to the level of criminal activity, that's what should happen. What our committee was worried about was the fact that disclosure brings with it the risk, albeit small, of undue influence on a witness.
Well, help me understand this, because you know, all my experiences have been, you know, being a policeman, you know, putting cases together, criminal prosecutions, but where you have experts in a civil trial, isn't the credibility of the witness fairly important?
I didn't hear the last thing.
The credibility of the witness. I mean, isn't that part of what you would try to do, is determine whether or not the witness, in fact, is an expert in their field or is, in fact, someone who's credible to a jury? And I guess I'm trying to get to the issue of the trial by ambush accusation. The folks that are the proponents of the bill say, look, it's really unfair to show up on the day of trial and then you get the name of the expert and you don't have the time to research who this person is or, you know, what their professional credentials are, and then you're in the midst of the trial. And I would have the tendency to agree that's a potential problem for the people who are trying to defend their client. So help me understand why that's not a problem.
Well, there are clearly two systems, and I have sort of taken the allegiance as a part of the Procedure and Practice Committee not to recommend which kind of truck you're going to buy here, just how smooth it's going to run after you buy it.
Right.
So I'm going to say, if this committee says, look, we ought to go to full pretrial disclosure under the federal and system and under the system that operates in every state other than Oregon and New York, or we're going to stay the way we are. But I'm saying, if you mix apples and oranges, you're going to have problems that you have not even thought of. And I'll give you an example. In Multnomah County, where I do most of my practice statewide, they assign the judge on the day of the trial or the day before the trial. And if you have pretrial matters, for example, if you're raising the issue of motion of whether to qualify this witness or not, that's going to be decided by another judge. Now, in the federal system, you get a judge at the beginning, he stays all the way through to the end of the trial, and he makes those pretrial decisions. But if we do this without thinking about that, for example, Judge Cantor may make a decision in Multnomah County, and then 6 weeks later, Judge Wires is going to try the case, and he wants to know where all that evidence is that got thrown out by Judge Cantor. Now, all I'm saying is we have to think about this as a balanced system. And if you pluck one of these issues out and change it, it may change things down the line. For example, the problems with multiple judges, the problems with not having a consistency in that process, a single judge. Another problem is 5 years in the qualifications is a long time. That's ancient history. And it would seem like that's a little bit too steep. Now, I'm moving now into, okay, if you're going to go this way, these are the changes that you need to think about. A lot of hard work has been put into this bill, and they're on the right track, but they've left some things out. So our position is that this piecemeal approach is not as effective as looking at the system. 3630, the House bill, apparently related to SAFE's involvement in the malpractice insurance issue, I believe provides some money to study these issues. We would wholeheartedly recommend that be done before we take this piecemeal approach. To get back to the issue of pretrial, although the current legislation does not allow for pretrial discovery in terms of depositions of these people, there will be a list of qualifications given and a list of publications authored over the preceding five-year period. I can think of maybe a dozen motions that could be filed challenging the sufficiency of that information, the timeliness of that information, and this is going to take those judges away from the criminal calendar, the domestic relations calendar, and the civil calendar to decide these pretrial measures, which are generally decided by the trial judge early on in the trial by motion. So it's really got nothing to do with the disclosure problem. It's, you know, what comes after that? Are we just grinding out more motions or more opportunities for motions? The proposal.
Mr. Chair. Sir, didn't the bill also require disclosure of trials that the experts have testified in previously?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, that's right. The qualifications are not only what your qualifications are, it's also what are your testimonial history, deposition, and case law trials, as well as publications you've authored.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you may want to take a look at something like the last five cases or the last five publications rather than publications over 5 years, because some witnesses, professional witnesses, testify weekly or monthly,
mm-hmm.
and they'll have 100 cases in 5 years. Or 20 cases in 5 years. Some people testify once or twice a year. They might have four or five. But in order to streamline or eliminate the paperwork, it might be smarter to say, okay, give me your most recent five cases. Once I talk to the five lawyers on the other side, I'll have you figured out pretty quick.
And then,
but the problem we still are left with is, of course, what happens with that information?
Right.
Does that information get disseminated outside of the trial team and the parties? Is there the protective order indicates that, you know, that could happen?
My follow-up question to that would be, if the expert can't remember all of the trials they've testified in because they've testified in many, and I know, as a court reporter, I know some physicians, they do a lot of that. And they don't keep track of it or maybe not remember. And if they don't disclose it all, they could be disqualified as an expert at trial because they didn't disclose all the trials they previously testified to. Wouldn't that be correct? Or are the publications that they've been in?
That is certainly a logical assumption that this kind of thing is going to happen. I mean, people are human. And the lawyers are going to make the most of that on both sides of the V. If I'm a defense lawyer and I see a plaintiff's doctor that's going to hurt me, I want to get rid of him, I want to ditch his testimony entirely, I'll file a motion and say he lied. He didn't, you know, tell me what mm-hmm. about the case in 1997.
That's right. Okay.
Counsel has a comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to that comment. The bill specifically says that a failure to disclose, for instance, a publication or a case, some qualification is grounds for a motion to require a new disclosure, but is not grounds for a motion to exclude a witness to avoid this very problem of endless motion practice on the sufficiency of the disclosure. So the intent was, so long as the name of the person was disclosed, then all the other information, if there was something wrong with it, you could file a motion for a new disclosure, but you could not file a motion to get the witness kicked out of the trial for failure to disclose. That was the intention of that particular section.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Joseph's comments are well taken, and that's true, and it's not a matter of ending the case for misconduct. It's our concern was the additional effort required by that. The sanctions section is critical from our perspective, as is the time limits. Other than that, I don't know that I have another comment, other than, again, to make a plea to this committee that maybe the wiser course here would be to take a long, hard look at the entire system. I was trying to explain this to my wife last night. She said, "Oh, you mean it's like changing the blueprint on our kitchen remodel? We moved the window 2 inches and found out 20 feet down the line that the dishwasher didn't fit anymore." And I know that's a simplistic example, but there are some consequences to this change in the law that are going to cost some money. And I just hope that everybody can see our concern in that regard before a final decision is made. And I thank you a lot for allowing me to appear here today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Morrell. Mr. Jack, do you have additional comments?
Yes, Senator, members of the committee, just a few brief comments. As Mr. Morrell indicated, I am very new to the committee, and I can say that from my attendance at our regular meetings, it is very clear that when people show up, they take off their plaintiff hats or their defense lawyer hats, and we really do evaluate what will be the impact of this particular rule change on the court system or parties. Will people be prejudiced one way or another from a decision that's made, from a rule that's proposed? And on this particular bill, the issue that was discussed in large part was it's half of a step, and we're not here to tell you whether or not your policy should be to authorize expert discovery or not have it at all, as it has been in the past in Oregon. That is your decision to make, but this is only half of the step, and it is only half of the information. If you're going to have expert discovery, you have expert discovery. You don't have part of a disclosure as is currently set forth in the bill. As you might guess, lawyers oftentimes think they're some of the smartest people on the planet over and above everyone else. And what you'll get, I think, when you start having at least disclosures of names is lawyers who can afford, and with clients who can afford, to have their lawyer conduct investigation into the background of an expert that's identified, as you'll see, I think, a number of pretrial motions challenging a particular expert and what that expert has to say at the time of trial. And there'll be pretrial motions. And then the second thing that you'll get is during the course of the trial, if I have a list of an expert's opportunities having testified for 5 previous years, you're going to have many trials almost on that person's testimony in various other cases. And lawyers, unfortunately, like to use all the paper they can get their hands on. And I suspect that we're going to see prolonged trials and further examination of experts. And again, that's not a bad thing if that's the rule that you decide we should have more disclosure of experts, and that ambush, trial by ambush, is in fact a bad thing. The thing that you need to understand is the exchange is going to be more pretrial proceedings and probably longer trials. The other things that our committee discussed were the fact that if you do intend to push a bill like this through, that you really should give some consideration to setting some kind of a cap on the dollar value of cases that it's applicable to. For smaller cases where the dollar amounts are lesser amounts, whether it be a business who's paying their lawyer by the hour or a contingent fee plaintiff, there's going to be a cost associated with obtaining that expert and collecting their information that's either going to come from that business owner in the form of cost or from a plaintiff in a contingent fee case in the form of additional costs that will come out of their recovery. So there is going to be an additional cost from that. In small dollar cases, you may not want to impose that cost. On larger cases, typically the ones that I see, very large dollar amounts, the amount of money associated with disclosing the name of an expert and collecting the information is probably not going to be a significant issue. It's a very small amount relative to what's in dispute, so it's probably not going to be a factor. You also may want to give some consideration to a brief identification of what subject matter, in very general terms, a particular expert's going to testify on. In some cases, you may have cases where most of your witnesses will be experts, and there may be 8 or 10 on each side. If you're going to have a disclosure, it should have some at least brief identification of what subject, in general terms, that person will testify on. The last thing is that our committee discussed was the timing issue, and Mr. Morrell touched on it briefly when he spoke. And that is 90 days before trial to have those kinds of disclosures is a long time, given the fact that all you're giving is a name and some basic background information. There's not going to be any follow-up depositions. There's not going to be any other follow-up that goes with it. 90 days is a lot of time to investigate that kind of information. We think that perhaps something more like 45 days for an initial and 21 days for rebuttal would be appropriate. Really, as a practical matter, the most anybody can do with that information is begin to investigate previous testimony, obtain transcripts, depositions, etc., again, if they can afford to do so. And at that point, there isn't going to be any more discovery. They may prepare pretrial motions, but I think it would be fair to say that any pretrial motion at that point in time is going to be heard the first day of trial. So you're going to have some delay in the beginning of your trial as these kind of pretrial motions get heard.
One sort of nuts and bolts issue related to this is that expert witnesses and their fees are not recoverable in state court. So if I'm paying $500 an hour for some geophysicist to talk to me, and we have to spend all this time cranking out this information to be sent in, and he charges me for that, even if I win, I don't get my expert witness fees paid. So it's just driving up the cost of the litigation. Even if I win and I'm not the bad guy, I don't get that money back. It still costs me that money. And Mr. Jack's point about the smaller cases, this looms large. I have to pay some doctor $5,000 to come in and testify about a $10,000 case, and I don't get that back when I win. It's going to be an economic consideration.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Morrell.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
All right. We are about 10 minutes over our time. There's a third panel. I'm not sure who they represent, Oregon Travelers. Is it what would the committee want to do? You want to stick around and hear their general testimony? Senator Starr has to leave. Do you have written testimony? I'm looking at
Alan. Some of the panel members did.
Okay. Perhaps you could submit the written testimony and we'll bring this back at a later time to hear your testimony, if that's okay. And I apologize for time delay.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I prefer to get oral testimony because I see one member in the audience who I find fascinating and provides really good testimony and has on occasion before Mr. Berger.
Right.
And so,
I just want the written testimony up front. If I can get it, if they've got it with them, then we'll bring them back and they can talk as long as they want.
When were we going to bring this back?
Good question. Next week.
Okay.
No, I can see that you're not pressuring me at all. Not at all. Okay, with that, any other business before the committee? No, we're going to be adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.